Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Friday, Donald Trump signed an executive order preventing travelers from seven Muslim-majority countries from entering the United States: Iraq, Syria, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. People traveling from those countries will be banned from entering the U.S. for 90 days. All refugee admissions will be suspended for 120 days. Syrian refugees are barred from entering the U.S. indefinitely. On Friday, Trump told the Christian Broadcasting Network that persecuted Christians would be given priority. The ban sparked widespread protests at major airports across the country as news of travelers being detained and deported spread. Visitors, permanent U.S. residents from the seven countries, and refugees from around the world were stopped at airports in the U.S. and abroad, including Cairo, Dubai, Istanbul, Geneva, and Amsterdam. Some people were blocked from entering the United States, while others were removed from airplanes and detained or deported, and many were handcuffed. According to NBC, the White House did not share details with the State Department, the Department of Justice, or the Department of Homeland Security, which created immediate chaos. For the latest recent developments and what's next in the legal challenges, we are joined by three guests. Catherine Toktokin is executive director and co-founder of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, an organization that works to defend and expand the rights of all immigrants and refugees, regardless of immigration status. And Catherine joins us in studio. Hi, Catherine. Nice to see you again.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in. We're also joined by Julia Harumi Mass, a senior staff attorney at the ACLU of Northern California, where she works on immigration issues. Hi, Julia. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you. And Banafshe Agrahi is civil and human rights lawyer in San Francisco. She founded the National Legal Sanctuary for Community Advancement, a nonprofit dedicated to ensuring the human rights and dignity of Middle Eastern, Muslim, and South Asian peoples. She's the author of Beautiful Reminders, and she joins us from her office in San Francisco. Hi, Banafshe. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be with you.
Well, thank you all for joining us. I just want to go over the executive order and what it actually does. Let's just talk about the basics. Catherine, people traveling from those seven countries, Iraq, Syria, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen, will be banned for 90 days, right? What happens after that?
Well, everything is up for review. So, you know, let's not even assume that there are only seven countries.
Okay.
The expectation is that those countries, that the number of countries could also be expanded. There are lots of countries that the U.S. has already identified as having terrorist activity. So, you know, there's a long list in the State Department, and I'm sure those are all going to be under review. So let's not assume it's only those seven countries. And, you know, and I assume people have seen a lot of the news that's already come out that interestingly, those seven countries, there is no one who has a national from those countries who has ever killed anyone in the United States, you know, one of those nationalities. However, there are certainly other countries, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, for example, where, incidentally, there are Trump businesses that are not on that list, that certainly there are nationals from those countries that have committed atrocities. So, you know, easily the list could be expanded.
And all refugee admissions will be suspended for 120 days. What does that mean exactly, all refugee admissions?
Well, you know, we do have a refugee program, and the United States has long touted its humanitarian role globally for accepting refugee admissions. And it's unfortunate that we are now penalizing those who are the most vulnerable, who are seeking refugee status, who are seeking asylum, that we are suspending those programs. And it's all part of a bigger reduction and undermining of our refugee programs. So President Trump proposes to cut total refugee admissions for fiscal year 2017 to 50,000 from the 110,000 that had been previously allocated under the Obama administration. And frankly, even the 110,000 was a drop in the bucket relative to the need to provide support to the most vulnerable.
And Syrian refugees are barred from entering the United States indefinitely.
Right. And and of course, I think we've certainly seen a lot of the pushback on that. More than 4.5 million Syrians have fled Syria in recent years because of the war. And, of course, many of them have gone into neighboring countries. They've gone towards Europe, and that is, you know, a movement that has certainly been part of flagging what we understand to be a global migration, a global refugee crisis. And this is what governments around the world are being called upon to respond to, with some humanitarian, stronger humanitarian approach. This is the subject of a, you know, was the subject of a major UN summit on refugees and migrants in September, and a commitment over the next 2 years to develop two new global compacts, one on migration and one on refugees. It's exactly to address the situation that President Trump is now undermining.
And Banav Shay, can you talk about the significance of the White House failing to provide details with the State Department, the DOJ, or the Department of Homeland Security? This is according to NBC News, and this is one of the reasons why we saw so much chaos and uncertainty over the weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, listen, we're even hearing from folks who are with DHS, USCIS, working on right alongside the refugee corps, and they've said they've received zero guidance, none whatsoever, as to what to do next. And very similar to the same kind of edicts that came out right after 9/11 and around NCRs and special registrations, if you remember. They, you know, set out these number of countries. They said boys, men, and senior citizens, 16 and older, need to come in and be registered. And again, there was really no guidelines, no guidance in how to be able to implement these rules, regulations, guidelines that they're rolling down from above. The implications are grave. I keep saying after 9/11, I started doing my work and representing the individuals that were being impacted in the day. We were under this umbrella of national security at that time. We're not under an umbrella of national security with this executive order. My concern is that if we are putting out these kind of regulations and from the highest office, right, the highest seat in the land, where are we going and what are we potentially causing? Back then, I would say the way in which we're handling human beings through the registration process, through the deportations, through the racial profiling will leave a bitter taste in the mouths of those that may have never had that to begin with. I wonder what we're causing today, and I'm really concerned about it.
And Julia, can you add to that and just talk about the significance of the White House failing to share details with these departments? Do we have any idea why the White House failed to do that?
Oh, I can't really speak to why that White House.
How unprecedented is this?
I've never, well, in the 14 years that I've been at the ACLU, I haven't seen anything like this. The effect, as you said, is total chaos. So at the airports this weekend, you know, there were all the people who were coming in who were being either turned around, pretty much were being turned around, forced to withdraw their applications to enter. Those were people who had already been screened by the State Department. They're people who had already been fully vetted and granted tourist visas or fiance visas or immigrant visas, meaning that the moment they stepped into the country, they would become lawful permanent residents. There's a very lengthy and thorough process that goes into that screening to allow somebody to enter with a green card, and those are the people who were being affected. And as a result, you know, they were being turned around. And then add on top of that the fact that because this was, raised such serious constitutional issues that right away the ACLU and several of its partners, the National Immigration Law Center and the Yale Law School Clinic, as well as the International Refugee Assistance Project, filed suit in New York. And the very day that the executive order was issued, and the very next day, Saturday evening, the District Court in New York issued an order saying, no, this executive order raises too many concerns. You cannot remove people who are entering with valid visas from these countries. And so that added another layer of chaos. And as a result, in the airports, you know, working, trying to work with Customs and Border Protection, you know, the dozens of lawyers and advocates and community members who went out to support families and try to assist travelers. They couldn't get any information about what's going on. And the officials that we were trying to talk to just kept saying things like, we're trying to figure it out, and we can't give you any information, and we're just waiting for directives, and we cannot tell you anything, and we're following orders. That's not a way for government to work, and that's why we saw it working so badly.
And over the weekend, lawyers could not see their clients in many cases. People were detained for a very long time and didn't have any way to get information?
Absolutely. There were people who, there was a couple, an elderly couple that entered at 6:30 in the morning, or that came, arrived at 6:30 in the morning on Saturday. They didn't get released until around 11 o'clock the next day. So
wow.
They were in custody for over 30 hours. The whole time, they had no communication, no means of communication with their family members who are waiting with that for them, or the lawyers who signed up and said, we've been retained to represent this couple. We need to talk to them. We need to find out what their conditions are that they're facing. What are their concerns? Given their what's happening and the uncertainty of the law, what are the decisions they want to make? We were not able to, and this was the Asian Law Caucus here in San Francisco, was trying to provide this support, as well as the Laura Street Community Services, and they were not allowed access to speak to their clients, and that meant that those folks were totally, you know, incommunicado, unable to know what was going on, and people couldn't make, you know, smart decisions for what kind of legal action to take without checking with them first.
Bonifshay, can you also talk about that as a lawyer? How difficult was it for you and your colleagues to get information, to get access to your clients?
Very difficult. No, but I do want to say one thing, Rose. I want to underscore something. Special registrations occurred in 2012. These were exactly the same things that took place then. This is very similar. Now, it was done with individuals that were in the United States, not individuals that were coming into the United States. We had that again similarly after 9/11 with a group of alumni who were coming from Sharif University in Iran, a technical university, for a reunion here in the United States. Midway during Condoleezza Rice's time, midway in air, all those valid visas were revoked. So upon entry at the port of entries across the country, they were all detained or deported and sent back. We have had it done in these cluster ways. We haven't had it done in this way. So yes, in the last 14 years, we haven't seen it in this way, but we've seen it in clusters, definitely in 2012 around registrations it began. So to say how has it been today or over the weekend, I would have to say to you that we need to not forget how we got here. How we got here is because of the Patriot Act. How we got here is we revived legislation like NSEERS that was used for the Japanese community to register them and intern them ultimately. How we got here is we have allowed for 16 years of these kinds of laws to embed themselves into the psyche of our country and have us become more readily available to have these kind of edicts to come through the White House. I'm not pro-Trump, I'm not pro-Obama, I'm pro-human. And what I really see at this juncture, which I have to say, on the positive side of thing, is that we have mass lawyers showing up to airports where we didn't have, after 9/11, we didn't have the numbers that we get to have now because of the events that have taken place after the last 16 years, and people have also become active. We haven't had the mass numbers of activists show up and community folks show up at the airports as we've had over the weekend and across this country. That's so absolutely encouraging. But I want us to remember that where we are today started long before today. So how has it been for the lawyers at the airports today? Very similar to the way it was before. We are not able to get to our clients. We have no idea what's happening on the other side of the doors with Customs and Border Protection. I've been making phone calls to the supervisor of Customs and Border Protection here in San Francisco, trying to get clients through, trying to give them the evidence that's needed to allow them to move through. We are hearing of more detentions taking place in LAX here at SFO. I have a client that should be landing at 12:45, coming in from Bahrain, Iranian young lady who is a green card holder. We don't know how it's going to go for her, as how many questions will be asked of her, if any, on the other side of customs, because there shouldn't be any, because she's a green card holder. We just don't know. And in this state of the frenzy of not knowing, my thoughts keep going back to after 9/11 and what can we do moving forward, learning from the past, moving forward so that we don't find ourselves here again.
And Julia, I know we have to let you go. Can you give us the latest in terms of the lawsuits that have been filed and what we can expect?
There have been a number of lawsuits that have been filed. In addition to the, in terms of the lawsuit in New York, my understanding is that there was there's first the initial order that I spoke about on Saturday night that prohibits the government from enforcing, from removing people based on the executive order. What we know in terms of how that we are working hard to make sure that, I mean, all over the country there are advocates that are working to try to make sure that order is followed, because we certainly have seen, and it's taken great efforts to push back on moves by officials locally to go ahead and remove people even after that order was issued. So that's a concern, is just enforcing it. I think that there will be developments in that case. My understanding is that there will be further developments and efforts to, kind of try to address the information vacuum that we're working with, in terms of being able to, you know, find out from the government how it's being, how the executive order is being implemented consistently with the court order, because the court order didn't ban the whole thing. So it's sort of finding out who's being affected and things like that, I think, is coming out of the New York case. In addition, I know that there was a case in Massachusetts that was filed, and an order issued there. That enjoined all parts of the executive order. This is the Massachusetts case, and ordered Customs and Border Protection to allow entry of individuals who've been granted admission.
And also, Julia, the ACLU was so busy under the George W. Bush administration, mm-hmm. and Banafshe made a point about this. This is not new. This happened after the Patriot Act was signed. What would you add to that?
I mean, I think there are a lot of similarities between this moment and that moment. I think what's really heartening, and I mean, but it's also very different, because that happened. There was a governmental overreach and an abuse of authority, and involved the violation of many people's rights. But it happened sort of in response to an extremely terrible attack on Americans. So it's a pretty different context. It didn't make it okay. It didn't make it legal. But this is coming sort of out of the blue, without any such terrible incident. It's just coming from, a president who, while he was on his campaign, really made incredibly racist and discriminatory remarks about all kinds of groups, and repeatedly, made remarks that were about Muslims in particular. So, actions that are being taken out of sort of explicit racial and religious discrimination are really different, and I think that's part of why you see such a huge upsurge and outcry from across the country, and all the protests and the incredible support that's coming to groups like ours that are working against it. So I think it's a really different moment, and you know, the very first challenge to one of his executive orders in his first week in office was immediately successful, and the court in New York immediately put a stay on the implementation of this order nationwide. So I think it's a different moment. I mean, it's the same kind of issues, but I think we're in a different moment in terms of the country's engagement and interest in pushing back on unconstitutional and abusive and discriminatory policies. And I think we've learned from the post 9/11 era also.
Well, Julia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Julia Harumi Mass is a senior staff attorney at the ACLU of Northern California, where she works on immigration issues. And joining us for the rest of the hour, Banafshe Alahi, civil and human rights lawyer in San Francisco. She founded the National Legal Sanctuary for Community Advancement. She's the author of Beautiful Reminders. And Catherine Toktokin is executive director and co-founder of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. And today we are talking about the Muslim ban that was announced on Friday. This executive order prevents travelers from 7 Muslim-majority countries from entering the United States, Iraq, Syria, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. People traveling from those countries will be banned for 90 days. All refugee admissions will be suspended for 120 days, and Syrian refugees will be barred from entering the United States indefinitely. NBC News reports that the White House did not share any details about this order with the State Department, the Department of Justice, or the Department of Homeland Security. And that is one of the reasons why there was so much chaos over the weekend. People just did not know what was happening. And if you have any questions or comments, if you have been affected by this personally, if you went to one of the actions at airports, thousands and thousands of people turned out at SFO and in Oakland and in Sacramento and then across the country. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Catherine, same question to you about context. You were on our show 2 weeks ago when we did a focused on President Obama's immigration legacy. For that show, we focused more on people coming from Central and South America. But how are you putting all of this into context when you look at the groundwork that's already been laid out for this?
Well, that's actually the point I would want to speak to. What is the groundwork? So it's interesting that, you know, just hearing the last couple of comments, we have another generation that has grown up under the Department of Homeland Security and probably has assumed that we've always had a Department of Homeland Security. This is an outgrowth of the response to 9/11. And, you know, we published a report a number of years ago, and others have also made this point, that we now have a what we call a policing regime in place. So when we drop this executive order in place, when President Trump dropped the 2 executive orders last week on interior and border enforcement, they fall into place within an infrastructure, a pretty consolidated framework of U.S. immigration policy of zero tolerance towards undocumented immigrants, a Department of Homeland Security that has been developed on a framework of national security. And those are some of the fears, of course, that Trump has played into. But it's an infrastructure. This is, you know, a massive enforcement process and structure that is in place that already has a life. We have had problems before these executive orders that have been challenged left and right on, you know, the problem of detention, of mass detention. And we saw in the executive orders this last week, we're increasing Border Patrol by 5,000, ICE, the Interior Enforcement Agents, by 10,000. Trump has said that he will expand detention and detention facilities, including going back to private prison companies. There have been restrictions, massive restrictions on due process. We're looking at expedited removal of people from the interior. So, you know, what has happened with, you know, this last executive order and the two that were announced this last week, you know, fall into a system and a process that is very, has become very deeply embedded. And we, what it is going to mean to change that, you know, Trump could not have said anything, frankly, and we would still have a huge problem on our hands. So, you know, I just wanted to make that point. And I think the multiple levels that we've already, you know, we've seen in response, the major legal litigation, the one-on-one legal assistance to people who are affected, the massive numbers of people in the street, the Women's March and the translation of that, you know, at the airports this weekend was, I mean, I was blown away.
You were there yesterday.
I was at SFO. I couldn't miss it. It was at SFO yesterday, and it was just incredible. The handmade signs, which I love a lot better than the mass-produced ones, that really conveyed a lot of, you know, people's personal perspectives and experience with this, and they were really connecting with these issues. I thought that was really meaningful. I just heard, and I haven't had a chance to see, the new, it's called, I think, the SOLVE Act, that has been introduced. Representative Lofgren from down here in San Jose in the House, and I think Feinstein in the Senate have introduced today to push back on the ban against Muslims. And we'll have to see where that goes. Over a dozen Republicans have voiced their opposition to the ban. These multiple levels of response are important, but I just want to make the point that we're working against a very consolidated infrastructure.
Catherine Tok-Tokin is executive director and co-founder of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Banafshe Alahi is a civil and human rights lawyer in San Francisco. She may have left us because she had an emergency call on these issues. Today, we are talking about Donald Trump's Muslim ban. He signed an executive order on Friday preventing travelers from seven Muslim-majority countries from entering the U.S., Iraq, Syria, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation today on Your Call. You can call us on the telephone. You can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may go to our website, which is yourcallradio.org. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, you may call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. 8255 toll free. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about how a teacher-led coalition defeated a charter school expansion initiative in Massachusetts, despite being outspent. 62% of Massachusetts voters defeated question two, which would have allowed up to 12 new charter schools every year. Wall Street execs, the Walton Foundation, and others funded the pro-charter side with $26 million. Teachers' unions spent $15 million. So we'll have a conversation about that on tomorrow's Your Call. Today, we are talking about Donald Trump's Muslim ban. On Friday, he signed an executive order preventing travelers from Iraq, Syria, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen from entering the U.S. for 90 days. All refugee admissions will be suspended for 120 days. Syrian refugees will be barred from entering the United States indefinitely. And today we're joined by Catherine Tok-Tokin, executive director and co-founder of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. And Banafshe Alahi is a civil and human rights lawyer in San Francisco and author of Beautiful Reminders. And Banafshe, I wanted to ask you, after this we got the decision from the ACLU lawsuit. I understand that government officials were not following the judge's order. Can you explain how that went down and why that happened?
I think it's because of the lack of communication and understanding of actually what's happening. So there's the you know, the edicts are passed, right, down the pathway. Then we've got the Customs and Border Patrol agents that are trying to mandate those laws. Then we have the events that took place in New York with the federal judge and the stay, and is that getting translated back and transferred back to the agents on the ground in a timely fashion is I think where the disconnect was. And being able to understand in the chaos of what's going on, you know, is part of it as well. So I think, I don't think that the on the agent's part, those employees that are trying to institute the edict and the laws, that there was any malice on their side. I don't think that they were doing anything attempting to be egregious. I don't believe that. I think that it's just inside of the state of the chaos and the confusion and not really understanding where we stand on the mandate that we had then, the additional detentions and the additional questioning and the delays.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Dylan in Berkeley. Hi, Dylan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I am the daughter of two immigrants, one from Iran in 1979 and one from Iraq in 1981. And so this has been really interesting to sort of navigate as the child of immigrants who mostly grew up under Obama's presidency during my formative years. But it's been a little disconcerting to hear a lot of people talk about this with like a rather exceptionalist tone, saying that this is something, you know, very, very new and very unprecedented. And while it is taking a turn for the drastic that I think a lot of us maybe weren't expecting, I still think it's really important to remember that these kind of lists and bans and limitations on who can come in and who cannot have been going on for a very long time. The Iranian community got quite the scare last year with H.R. 168 going through and the amount of surveillance and the sort of surveillance state that has been imposed on and that has been experienced by Muslim Americans in particular since even before 9/11, but especially since 9/11, has just increased in terror exponentially every year.
Right. Yeah, Banafshe, can you comment on that?
Absolutely. I agree with the caller. I mean, that's where I think there's been a disconnect. The disconnect has been that slowly, we have been eroding the base of what we stand for here as it relates to immigrants. And as the caller stated, you know, the mandate that was sent out under Obama's administration has very similar tones to what Trump has just done. Mm-hmm. Same nation states. Doesn't matter if whether or not you're a citizen of now a third country, so you could be a citizen of France, for example, hold the passport of France, but if you were born in Iran or in one of those named countries, you still have issues of entrance into the United States, if at all, right? So these are and I think your other guest mentioned this as well, very well, that this has now become the fabric of, we now have a whole new generation under the umbrella of Department of Homeland Security, which didn't exist until 2013 in this country, 2003 in this country. So we have to start to remember, and it's not that long ago, I mean, in our memory bank, it's not that long ago, that we need to start to look to see how did we build to get to this point. We are at this point now, and while we're at this point, and I want to really underscore this, the beauty of and the fact that we have so many standing on these issues, and not just on these issues, but environmental issues, on women's rights issues, on the Native American issues and land issues, and the issues go on, right, because this presidency has brought so many of these issues to the forefront. It's brilliant that folks are coming together and they're voicing togetherness on all of this. But we cannot turn our eye as to how we arrived here, in particular on the immigration issue.
Catherine, what would you add?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. We once did a study, and I'm thinking we should renew that, on the whole history of exclusion. to the United States. And, you know, we have this reputation that we, you know, the land of liberty, you know, the Statue of Liberty. And yet this country has an extremely ugly history of exclusion of just about every nationality on Earth. And, you know, some of those exclusions stood, you know, into the last century. Our last, you know, major immigration bill, the Immigration and Nationality Act in 1965 did away with racial quotas. So it's not that really that long ago that this country and generations now and just before us are very familiar with a whole racialized, you know, and nationality biased approach to immigration and refugee policy.
Well, thank you for calling in, Dylan. Let's go next to Ray in San Francisco. Hi, Ray. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. The reason that as of Saturday, the executive order still had not been decided upon nor signed, but they said that they had done it on Friday. He could sign it on Monday or Tuesday and backdate it till Friday, but that's why they couldn't share it with the other departments, because it wasn't a law yet. So,
where are you getting your information, Ray?
Well, I'm a military officer and a government official, and I have open sources, which are not classified, and I found it there and there and there, various places. And I heard about it talked on the radio that they said, like the guy interviewing him said, you mean the law went into effect before there was a law? And the guy said, yeah. And the guy said, isn't that backwards? Shouldn't there be a law before it begins enforcement? He goes, yeah, usually that's the case. So, and the thing about the...
I have not heard anything about this. In fact, didn't we see Donald Trump signing the executive order on Friday?
I thought we did, to great fanfare.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't heard of this either.
All right. I'm not sure where you're getting your info, Ray, but it was broadcast on the news when Donald Trump actually signed this order on Friday. And then various news outlets are saying that the information was not shared with the State Department, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Homeland Security, which is unprecedented. Catherine?
Well, it was not shared ahead of time.
Right.
So, you know.
So people didn't know what was coming.
Yeah. Law is very complicated, and it has to go down through the channels. But, of course, yeah. So whether Donald Trump even realized, you know, with his vast knowledge, that that was even necessary is another question.
All right. Let's go to our next caller, Navid. Hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. Yeah, so I am an immigrant myself, and I came to this country as an immigrant, and I remember the vetting process to be very rigorous, and it took many years for me to actually obtain my citizenship. And I recently obtained my citizenship, and I saw that process. So this whole idea that the Trump administration is putting forth, that, you know, we don't know who is coming in, is very mythical. And this executive order, what it has done is that it's creating much anxiety among my family and friends who are from Iran, and they are either here on visas or green cards, or they're hoping to get their citizenship, and they have brought their intellectual and financial capital to this country, but they are being treated very poorly and being discriminated against. And the six other nations that are on the list, they're also very worried. I am a PhD student at Columbia University, and a lot of our students have background from Iraq, Yemen, Iran, and the other countries that are on the list, and now they're in limbo because they do not know what they're supposed to do, and this executive order can cost careers and lives for many people who are trying to be productive members of the American society.
And so, Navid, what are you hearing from your friends in terms of, you know, what I mean, some people have been stranded in airports. I've read articles about people who are on their way are stranded in, you name the country, Dubai, and they live here. I mean, one woman said, my car is still at the airport. My dog is at home. I mean, this is so uncertain for so many people, individuals, families, students, immigrants. I mean, so many different stories from these seven different countries.
That's right. And one specific story I have in mind is my aunt, who recently got her green card, and now she's not sure. And she's been meaning to see her daughter for years, who is in Texas. And now it seems like she's not sure whether she can come. And I mean, it appears that they said green card holders are exempt. But so far, we had a very kind of chaotic application of this executive order. So we don't really know what to expect. And I also have a lot of colleagues who are from Iran at various American universities, and they are abroad doing ethnographic research. I have a colleague who's doing ethnographic research in Afghanistan on Iranian, and he has a visa, and he studies at Yale, and it's not clear whether he can actually come back to Yale to finish. And I have another friend who's finishing his PhD at UC Santa Barbara in California, where the show is being aired. And he's in Iran right now doing some very productive tourism business, and it seems like he can't come back to California to finish his PhD.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Navid. Navid is a student at Columbia University. And can you talk a little bit more about this, Banafshe? I mean, we're hearing a lot of personal stories. The New York Times had an article about people who've been affected. In addition to people that Navid was talking about, family members, for example, six members of a family from Syria have been living in a refugee camp in Turkey, and they were scheduled to fly to the United States on Monday. And an organization in Cleveland found an apartment for them to rent with another family of Syrian refugees. Those plans have been canceled. So we're talking about students, doctors, refugees who've lived in refugee camps for up to 2 years in some cases.
Yeah, it's the only word that comes to mind is inhumane. It's just this is, and we hear it repeatedly. This is un-American. This is not what we stand for. It's just inhumane. Forget about un-American. Forget about this not what we stand for. This is just at any lens you look at this, from any perspective you look at this, at any location on the planet, whether it's here in the United States or otherwise, you look at this, this is inhumane. I've received calls from here at SFO. I've received calls from folks in New York, the folks in Los Angeles. I've been inundated over the weekend at these various ports of entry, and the stories, five-year-olds being held in detention away from their family members, 75-year-old women who are in on wheelchairs being held for 9 hours plus and who don't speak English well and not able to access their family members who are on the outside waiting for them, and they're diabetics. And the list goes on. Two pregnant women who went into contractions and had to be rushed to the hospital, both green card holders. It just goes on and on. It's all under that umbrella of inhumane. And I don't even touch this from the prism of un-American anymore, because, again, this is exactly the kind of things that we were doing when we were rounding people up around special registrations. Individuals who were coming in thinking that they were going to do nothing more than be photographed, fingerprinted, because they were told to, because they were one of the nation, the nations of interest on the list, and they had just come out from having triple bypass surgery, and they were now being detained and shackled around the ankles. Mm. You know, the way in which that we are treating other human beings from other named countries is not going to go unanswered. As we behave the way we continue to behave, and we do so decade after decade, under whichever administration you want to be looking at, they all have been moving us in this direction. These things are not going to go unanswered. So while we're in the frenzy of being at various airports, while we're in the frenzy of trying to get activists out on the out in the field, we're losing sight of other activities that are taking place by this administration that took place this weekend, right? The kind of executive orders that went into effect for the National Security Council, that now Barron has a seat where generals used to be.
Right.
So we have to be able to look at the big picture. We have to be able to see how we got here, while, of course, being vigilant and taking care of business in the ways that we possibly can, whether, you know, we're activists on the ground, journalists out there like yourselves, the various NGOs that are out there doing great work attorneys and such. But we've got to keep this not just in the lens of this moment and in this time, but in the grander picture of what's happening in this moment and this time and how we got here, even a larger picture than that.
Yeah, we have an email from Brenda who says that this is, we need to also focus on the cabinet appointees that Trump is ramming through Congress. This is happening this week, today, and tomorrow. Major votes on maybe more than 8 cabinet appointees.
Absolutely.
Well, and then with Steve Bannon, like you said, who has been put on the National Security Council. And I'll ask you both a question about that. But first, I wanted to bring in Laura Kiswani, Executive Director of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center. It's a grassroots organization working to empower and organize the Arab community towards justice and self-determination. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for calling in. How are people in the Bay Area, how have they been impacted by this?
In all sorts of ways. You have families who have been separated from their family members trying to return from their homelands, whether that's Yemen or Iraq or different parts of in Iran. You also have people who haven't been able to return, folks who've lived here for years and denied entry to the United States on their way en route in Egypt. And then yesterday, you know, over the weekend, people have been showing out en masse to support the immigrants who have been arriving at SFO and then detained. So it's been a really difficult experience for all those people who have been directly impacted by this executive order.
What advice are you giving to people at this point? There's a Know Your Rights campaign for immigrants and refugees. I mean, this really kicked in right after 9/11. But what are you telling people about their status and what they should do at this point?
Well, we're telling people not to comply on every level, so not just Arab and Muslim community, but everybody. But in terms of the Arab and Muslim community, it's about knowing your rights, about knowing your options. It's knowing that you shouldn't be traveling. We're encouraging people not to leave the United States if you do not have a U.S. passport, and not to comply with any law enforcement. If ICE or FBI or anyone shows up at your door, your workplace, your school, we're also doing a lot of education in schools and in the community and in neighborhoods so allies know how to defend and protect those people being targeted, including undocumented immigrants. The most important thing is for people to know that they do not have to answer to any law enforcement, that they have organizations to turn to for support and defense, and lawyers, and there's a huge community of lawyers who are ready to defend immigrants being targeted, and then to organize against it. The main thing that we want to get everyone bought into is that it's not enough to just not comply. It's not enough to talk about sanctuary city. It's not enough to fight lobby in Washington, D.C. What we want is to cultivate a culture of resistance where people are speaking out against this racist attack on the Arab and Muslim community, on the Latino community, on Black and Brown and communities in the United States, and to make sure that they're speaking out in media, they're making their stories heard, and they're resisting by any means necessary.
Well, Laura, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Laura Kiswani is Executive Director of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center. Catherine, in this context, what does it mean for people to resist this executive action?
Well, I agree. I mean, we just, our information site on our website is called Resist. But it really has to be at multiple levels. So, in terms of the breadth of what we're facing, and it's not an accident that we've been hit over the head, this last week with multiple elements that have that haven't divided us, but have diverted our attention. And we have to pay attention to everything, but at the same time, we have to be able to effectively leverage our support on key things. So mm-hmm. I think that's very important. So the grassroots movement, I am energized by the work that's being done at the local level, because that's really where we have to transform thinking and mobilize people. And it's not just the work in the street. It is also the pressure on members of Congress, mm-hmm. and they need to hear that. And we need to be in D.C. if we can. We have to hit the halls of Congress. We're going to have a Supreme Court and a White House totally lined up against us. A Congress that has been hostile on these issues for the last how many years? We have to neutralize the most rabid voices, and we have to shore up champions. And I think as a movement, we can't let that go. We cannot afford to let that go. So our movement in the streets has to be able to back that, but we also have to get those voices on the inside. And there are levels of pressure that we haven't even examined yet that we're going to have to do. And I would just say, we haven't seen a lot of things come down yet. We haven't seen Trump reverse immigration policy, which he has said he is going to do. He wants to change our current immigration policy, turn it on its head, and move it away from family-based immigration, for example. That's, you know, that's going to be historic. We are hearing on the southern border, thousands of people are being moved directly into detention. And the group people coming across the border now are not mainly Mexicans. The majority are what they say, OTMs, other than Mexicans. Mm. These are Middle East. These are Haitians. These are Central Americans. They are asylum seekers. And we're seeing a dangerous pattern of detention now, thousands of asylum seekers. So it's the ban is a major part of this that's going to frame that, but there's a lot of stuff happening, and we have to pay attention to all of those elements.
And Banafshe, I know you have to leave us. Quick final thoughts?
Just, I want to thank you. I want to thank you. I want to thank this radio station. I want to thank the guests you've had and the individuals who've come on to engage in this conversation. The more we do this, I mean, really, this is the fourth arm of our democracy is you all, the journalists. So that's my first, is I want to underscore the work you're doing, the importance of that. And the next is, you know, I agree with your guest, vigilance. Get out, keep speaking, keep moving, keep being active. But more importantly, get inquisitive. Ask the questions. Go deeper. That power of inquiry is critical. If at any time, it would be now. Thank you so much. And however I could be of assistance in the future, please don't hesitate to contact me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Banafshe Ahlahi is a civil and human rights lawyer in San Francisco. And Catherine, since we got an email about the votes, I do want to mention this because it's really important. There is a full Senate vote on Rex Tillerson today, a committee vote on Steve Mnuchin. Tomorrow, lots of committee votes. Jeff Sessions, Rick Perry, Ryan Zinke, Tom Price, Betsy DeVos, and a full Senate vote on Elaine Chao. So now is the time to call your senator if you haven't already. The phone lines have been packed. And I wanted to end asking you about the significance of Donald Trump appointing Steve Bannon to sit on the National Security Council. Some in the media have simply called him a news executive. I mean, this is a white nationalist who ran Breitbart News, which is a platform for white nationalists. This is really getting underplayed in the media for some reason. What is the significance of appointing someone like Steve Bannon to sit on the National Security Council?
Well, your question
is the main group advising the president on national security and foreign affairs.
Your question says it all. The fact that he was appointed a senior advisor in the first place, and I think many people assume he's running the White House, is extremely dangerous. He has prided himself in being, you know, in Breitbart being the voice of the alt-right. And what is the alt-right? You know, it's deep into white nationalism. It's extremely dangerous. And again, this is one more thing. Let's not assume this. People, we have to push back on it. And it's outrageous that any news outlet would just refer to him as a news executive.
Well, and this, the National Security Council, I mean, so many of us are learning about how government really works, right? A lot of people just don't know some things, but a lot of people are learning. This is the main group that advises the president on national security and foreign affairs.
And he also has his son-in-law in there, too.
Right, Jared Kushner.
Right.
Well, I'm definitely going to pitch a show about Steve Bannon and who he is, because according to reports, he's the one that's writing a lot of these executive orders.
Oh, I think so. I mean, if you look at the messaging also that has come through, and if anyone has followed Breitbart, you will see this. It's really dangerous, and people have to get smart also to read what the right is writing. I've seen a lot of things coming through recently in the last week that people thought, this sounds good, and it comes right out of the right, and just be very careful.
Catherine Tuck-Talkin is executive director and co-founder of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Catherine, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks so much for the great job you're doing.
Thank you. On tomorrow's show, we're going to talk about how a teacher-led coalition defeat a charter school expansion initiative in Massachusetts, despite being outspent by dark money and out-of-state contributions. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Email us feedback at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.